Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 3.5 weeks after the explosion and collapse of the massive Deepwater Horizon drilling platform in the Gulf of Mexico, a siphon tube is in, but the oil spill crisis goes on. It's already being called the worst environmental disaster in U.S. history. Many Americans, including very recently the president, have seen offshore drilling as an essential bridge to energy independence. Others look at the environmental price tag and say, this can't be worth it. This hour on Point American Energy, the disaster in the Gulf, and the future of offshore drilling. You can join the conversation. Could we live without more offshore drilling? Is that naive? Can we really drill without the kind of damage we're seeing right now? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from New Orleans is Mark Schlefstein, environment reporter for the Times-Picayune. He's been following the latest on the spill and efforts to stop it. Mark Schlefstein, thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
So tell us about this tube that's been inserted, 4-inch tube in a, 21-inch pipe, and what do we know about how that's going?
Well, according to the company this morning, it's picking up about 42,000 gallons of material a day at that rate, but it's only been in there for a little bit less than a day, so I'm sort of curious how they came up with that estimate, but we'll let it go for what it is. That's about 20% of the oil that is coming out of the leak, if one believes the estimate of 5,000 barrels a day being released from the bottom of the ocean. There, of course, have been other estimates that
far higher,
5 to 10 times as much oil. So, but it's a start, and hopefully this will begin to they'll be able to ramp up the amount of oil that they're able to capture from that one hole in the pipe where they've got this straw, is what I call it, stuck into the pipe.
How transparent is BP being at this point? In retrospect, they don't seem to have been very transparent over these recent weeks about how this is going, about the flow, about how much is seawater and how much is oil that they're sucking up.
Well, transparency doesn't seem to be an issue here at all.
Doesn't seem to be an issue. Doesn't seem to be a reality, I guess.
Right, right. The reality is that the only videos that we've received have been released. There's been one, and it was released immediately. Not immediately, but after many news organizations complained that they hadn't seen anything, and after the federal government had complained that they hadn't seen anything, there are little cameras on the backs of all these remote operating vehicles that actually were used prior to this spill by a group of scientists that work in the Gulf of Mexico looking at underwater life, and it's been really surprising that they haven't release some of the video from those cameras.
Surprising or
maybe
not.
It's not, I mean, surprising. Mm. Well, because it would, you know, I think that it would be better for the public to understand exactly what the breadth and depth of this spill actually is.
What can you tell us about the breadth and depth at this point? I'm reading something like a slick 80 by 150 miles, and that goes that's without looking at the so-called plumes underwater.
Exactly. That's the problem is trying to get your hands around exactly what this is, because they have done such a good job of using these dispersant chemicals to break up this oil into tiny little droplets. It's very difficult to figure out exactly where all this oil is going. But there are indications from what we can see from satellite photos, what people are actually seeing from ships, that there are huge amounts of oil that are out there. Some of it has broken up. This is a light crude, so it's very clear that a significant chunk of this oil has basically just disappeared by becoming gas, gassing off. Mm-hmm. But there's still a heck of a lot of oil that's out there. The lucky part of this is that very little of it has come ashore. And if you listen to the statements of BP, that seems to be their key strategy, is to make sure that this stuff doesn't go to shore. But what that sort of leaves out is whether or not where this oil is actually causing significant problems.
Even if it's a marine experience rather than a coastal gathering of the oil.
Exactly. Unfortunately for BP and for the rest of us, the timing of this spill is significantly bad for the life cycle of fish in the Gulf of Mexico. For instance, the bluefin tuna, the Atlantic bluefin tuna, which should be on the endangered species list according to numerous scientists, but has been blocked from being there by Japan, which wants to continue fishing it. Well, its spawning period is from March until June. And the place where the population that basically starts life in the Gulf of Mexico, where they begin their life, is actually on this slope of the Gulf of Mexico, on the north slope, exactly where this well is. In fact, we had a story that showed the path of one of those fish from last year, a 700-pound tuna, going by the rig twice over that same period of time while it was spawning in the Gulf of Mexico.
You've already got a kind of a dead zone there in parts of the Gulf. Is it possible that this could create a much greater dead zone? The scientists coming back ashore were talking about dead bacteria all over the place, oxygen depletion because of the oil. What about that?
That is a concern, and you know, the traditional dead zone is caused by nutrients coming down the Mississippi mm-hmm. River and ending up creating algae blooms on the surface of the water right off the coast of Louisiana. This dead zone would be a bit the same, but also a bit different. One of the big problems here is that if you look at the cycle of life in the Gulf of Mexico, there is a huge amount of production that occurs right on that very thin top of the ocean, that tiny, you know, a tenth
fraction,
of an inch
yep.
Piece of the ocean. And this oil, because it is lighter than water, ends up being in that area and is disrupting that life. And then you have all of this oil that now has been broken up into tiny little droplets that is dropping to the bottom of the ocean, that is killing what's called benthos, those tiny other tiny organisms and a little bit larger organisms that live in the sediment on the bottom of the ocean and actually can't move around very much, so they can't escape it.
It comes
so
down.
Both of those areas are real problems.
It comes down and rains on them. Mark Celestine with the Times-Picayune, environment reporter there. Thank you very much for joining us from New Orleans, Mark.
Thank you.
Here's on NBC's Meet the Press yesterday, here's Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky saying he doesn't think that there'll be any abandoning of offshore drilling anytime soon, even after the oil spill.
Look, we can't walk away, and the president's not suggesting this either, from offshore drilling. As horrible as this is, it's important to remember that we get 30% of our oil from the Gulf, and if you shut that down, you'd have $14 gasoline.
30% and $14 gasoline. Joining me now from Washington, D.C. is Daniel Lashoff. He's director of the Climate Center at the Natural Resources Defense Council, an environmental action group. The group has called for a timeout on new drilling. Daniel Lashoff, welcome to On Point.
Thanks, Tom.
So what exactly are you calling for in the aftermath of this gigantic spill?
Well, the first thing we do need is a timeout until we fully understand what happened with this disaster in the Gulf that continues to unfold. We need to tighten the regulations. We need an independent review of what happened before we go forward with any new drilling. But beyond that, we certainly should take this graphic illustration of the cost of our dependence on oil to enact comprehensive energy reform that begins to end our addiction so that we can avoid being dependent on this clearly dirty and dangerous fuel.
After Three Mile Island and the nuclear scare there, this country more or less shut down new nuclear plant construction. Do you see that happening with offshore drilling? Should we shut down new exploration? Should we shut down pumping?
Well, I don't think we're going to shut down pumping from existing wells. That is a significant fraction of our energy, and we're certainly not calling for that. But we certainly should take a time out before we expand into any new areas. We don't think that's necessary at all. And there are clearly areas such as the pristine Beaufort Sound in Alaska that should be permanently off limits. It doesn't make any sense to be drilling off of our critical habitat and tourist areas off the east coast of the United States. And the amount of oil that would be expected from expanding offshore drilling into these new areas is tiny compared with other opportunities both to reduce our demand for oil and even is actually 10 times less than what we could do by expanding production of oil from existing onshore fields using a technique called carbon dioxide enhanced oil recovery. Not something many people have heard about, but a huge opportunity that we could get from a comprehensive bill that limited global warming pollution and created incentives to expand domestic onshore production.
But the president was out there, just 6 weeks ago saying we need more offshore drilling to bridge to an energy independent future. We need it.
And I think that was a mistake then. I think, obviously, a mistake now. I think that he proposed that as an olive leaf to folks who wanted to focus on drilling as the heart of an energy strategy. But the reality is that that was never going to produce a significant share of our energy needs, and we just don't need to do it.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking in the shadow of the Gulf oil spill disaster about whether the U.S. could live without offshore drilling or without more new offshore drilling. Here's President Obama at a press conference in the White House Rose Garden on Friday, urging oil executives to take more responsibility for the Gulf disaster, but also indicating that offshore drilling would still be part of his energy agenda.
Domestic oil drilling continues to be one part of an overall energy strategy that now includes more clean, renewable energy and energy efficiency than at any other time in our history. But it's absolutely essential that going forward we put in place every necessary safeguard and protection so that a tragedy like this oil spill does not happen again.
President Obama on Friday. Daniel Lashoff joins us from Washington. He's director of the Climate Center at the Natural Resources Defense Council. And with us right now from Austin, Texas, is Robert Bryce, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute for Policy Research. He's managing editor of the Energy Tribune and author of the new book, Power Hungry, The Myths of Green Energy and the Real Fuels of the Future. Robert Bryce, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Give us your perspective here. You know, a lot of people look at these maps of that oil just spreading and spreading in the Gulf. They look at the economy of that huge region of the country, which is widely expected to be laid waste, and at the marine life and this extraordinary cost of this. It may come around the tip of Florida now and even up the East Coast. And people say, you know, some people are asking, what is offshore oil worth? This doesn't happen very often, but if the cost is this high, should we, could we stop? What do you say?
Well, look, Tom, the spill, or it's a blowout. It's not a spill. It's a blowout. It's horrific,
yep.
And it's awful. And I say, I live in Texas. I vacation in the Gulf of Mexico. I swim,
yep.
I fish, I birdwatch in the Gulf. This
yep.
is terrible. And the long-term environmental impacts may be worse than the Exxon Valdez, and the policy impacts are going to reverberate in U.S. In the U.S. for years to come. But as bad as this is, I'm an energy realist. It doesn't change the laws of physics, nor does it change the global oil demand picture. Last week, the Libyan airliner crashed and killed 103 people, but we haven't heard anyone calling for a global suspension of air travel.
Yes, but that only messed up a little area around the airfield, not an area the size of the Gulf of Mexico.
Fair enough, and I'm not going to sit here and say this is a small issue. It's not. The point is that if oil didn't exist, we'd have to invent it. I understand Mr. Lashoff's position. I understand he's a smart guy. But this idea of ending our addiction, avoid being dependent on the dirty, dangerous fuel. If oil didn't exist, we'd have to invent it.
What about offshore oil? Could we stop drilling, or could we stop exploring for more, drilling for more?
Sure, I got you. Of course, we can stop, but it is not going to stop slow global demand, nor will it slow global offshore oil and gas exploration. The Exxon Valdez spill was in 1989. Mm-hmm. At that time, global oil demand has increased by 20 million barrels per day, roughly. In 20 years, demand has increased 20 million barrels per day. But of that 20 million barrel per day increase in demand, the U.S. demand only increased 1.6 million barrels per day. The reason BP is out there in 5,000 feet of water is because that's where the resource is. The non-OPEC resource is available. And oil demand continues growing. So, yes, the U.S. can slow or completely stop offshore production, but it doesn't. If that happens, then it will mean the U.S. will import more oil. And we know both the left and the right are opposed to oil imports.
Daniel Lashoff, how about just that point? Yes, we could hold back, and there's a lot of calls, certainly up and down the West Coast already, senators out there saying, not here, never, Arnold Schwarzenegger kind of coming around. East Coast looking at this with some trepidation as that oil may now round the tip of Florida and come up. But, you know, could we, should we, Daniel Lashoff, say, let's de-emphasize that? Even though the president just said a few weeks ago, let's go get it, should we de-emphasize that, and could we turn elsewhere?
Well, absolutely. Look, oil was the fuel of the 20th century, but it's not the fuel of the 21st century. We have much better alternatives now, starting with much more efficient ways to move around, shifting to electric and plug-in hybrid vehicles. The EPA has estimated we could reduce our demand for oil by 7 million barrels a day. Add to that 3 million barrels a day we could produce from existing onshore fields in a much safer manner than going offshore, and compare that to the American Petroleum Institute's estimate that we would get at most 300,000 barrels a day from expanded offshore drilling. So we have much better alternatives, and what we need is a comprehensive plan. It's not just about not expanding drilling. It's about a comprehensive energy and climate policy that will drive down demand for oil, expand our use of cleaner and better alternatives, and end our dependence both on offshore dangerous oil from our Gulf and from the East Coast, as well as reduce our dependence on imports.
We're going to look at energy alternatives, energy plans, but what about the simple fact of where the oil is, Robert Bryce? Could we move our attention onshore, go after the oil that Daniel Lashoff says is there, and not be at sea where any mistake gets, you know, carried in that water so devastatingly?
Sure. Well, NRDC has been talking about CO2 enhanced oil recovery, and look, that's a very valuable technique. I wrote about it in the New York Times briefly last week.
Mm-hmm.
And and CO2 floods work, but this is not going to be the cure all for American energy policy. The U.S. has 250 million motor vehicles on the road. We have 10,000 commercial aircraft. We can't fuel them all with wishes and dreams. We need oil, and that's fortunate, unfortunate. The global transportation sector, forget about the U.S. for a minute. The global transportation sector depends on oil. So, yes, the U.S. can cut demand, but it's not going to slow offshore oil and gas exploration offshore Brazil, Angola, Venezuela, Nigeria, Australia. This is not, if you look globally, this has not slowed offshore oil and gas exploration at all.
It was drill, baby, drill the last time this was fully in the spotlight. Now, with the Gulf of Mexico just unbearably polluted, people are wondering. You can hear politicians struggling with this. Here's Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer on NBC's Meet the Press yesterday arguing you should push for energy independence, even if that includes more offshore oil.
Americans want to be independent of foreign oil. That's right. It's killing us, both economically, foreign policy-wise, and everything else, to take people, countries like Iran and Venezuela that hate us and make them rich. So everyone is now looking anew at domestic sources of energy production. Clean energy would be the priority, but people are looking at others, nuclear, offshore, things like that. And that's going to continue, but people want to make sure that if we're going to do it, it's going to be a lot better and a lot safer than what happened in the Gulf.
A lot better and a lot safer, but we were told just 6 weeks ago that's where we already are. Let's get our callers in here. Fairfield, Iowa. Alan, you're on the air, Alan.
Yes, I'd like to commend your speakers for talking from their point of view, but apparently they really have not done the research on the true alternatives that are available. The intelligence power of this country has sequestered tremendous amount of technologies, which, if released to the public sector, would make it possible for us to completely do without oil and natural gas entirely.
You think somebody's already got it out there, hid it in a closet, Alan, and they're not telling us?
Absolutely. For example, just an example of a technology.
Okay.
Our military aircraft, some of the stealth fighters and bombers, they take off with ordinary jet engines, and then they switch to electrogravitics. Electrogravitics. The zero-point energy is something which is very real and is utilized by the secret aspects of our military and the intelligence power.
Alan, we're going to pick it up. I'm not sure exactly what the intelligence power is, but we'd sure like to have that alternative if it's out there. Let me get one more call first. Omaha, Nebraska, Laverne. Laverne, you're on the air.
Yeah. Efficiency has not been done. We're not using carbon fiber cars with running on hydrogen. We haven't insulated in every single home and every single business.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't changed windows in every single home and every single business. You know, Obama spent $8 billion on a nuclear power plant that's going to create 800 permanent jobs. $8 billion in efficiency will create thousands of jobs and totally increase, you know, everybody's efficiency,
yeah, yeah.
All the infrastructure. Amory Lovins describes this in the 2003 Winning the Oil Endgame, $180 billion, and we're oil-free in 25 years.
Do you think we need more offshore drilling, Laverne? Do you think we need it?
What was that again?
Do you think we need more offshore?
No, we don't. We need to stop drilling. I don't want the spills in Nigeria. I don't want the spills in the Gulf. I don't want the spills up in Alaska, like some people were saying. It'd be so much better if it happened up in the Antarctic. Oh, yeah, just kill off all the nature.
Laverne, no, we've got it. Let me take it to my guest, Robert Bryce. First of all, to Alan's, you know, what about the true alternatives available? He says there's plenty out there. We're just not using them.
Oh, we've been hearing about the alternatives now for 30 or 40 years. It's the focus of my new book,
mm-hmm.
Power Hungry.
Mm-hmm.
Look, the myths of green energy are largely just that. I take no pleasure in saying that. Electric cars are nothing new. We heard the New York Times was talking about electric cars in 1911.
What are the myths of green energy now, then?
I'm sorry?
The myths of green energy now are what, then?
Well, I mean, look, oil is the fact is hydrocarbons are here to stay. We can badmouth oil, coal, natural gas all we like. 9 out of 10 units of energy, 9 out of 10 units of power that we consume globally come from hydrocarbons. Any transition away from them will be a decades-long process.
What about wind and solar?
Well, wind and solar have their place. I think the wind energy business has largely been vastly oversold. I'm hopeful on solar. I think it has its place. But those two technologies do not displace the demand for oil. We use very little, almost no electricity in the transportation sector. And transportation is almost wholly dependent globally on the oil business.
Does the military have something up its sleeve we don't know about, electrogravitics?
Oh, I've heard, I've heard this forever. I've heard these kind of claims for years, and that there's some, you know, and that GM and Ford bought the super special battery technology, and they're keeping it off the market. I just don't believe it.
Daniel Lashoff, you're our environmentalist here. You heard Laverne in Omaha saying, come on, if we go to efficiency, we don't need to go offshore. Do you agree with that? If we went full bore on the efficiency effort, insulation and carbon fiber cars and all the rest, we could put the brakes on offshore drilling?
Absolutely. I think Laverne is absolutely right. Our greatest resource is becoming more energy efficient. We could reduce our oil demand by 7 million barrels a day. It's not something we can do overnight. So I agree that this is a decades-long process of weaning ourselves off of oil, all the more reason to start immediately. The previous caller is looking for a magic bullet, and Mr. Bryce tends to argue, well, you know, any one individual technology is not going to end our dependence on oil. And that is absolutely true. There's not going to be a single replacement. But with a comprehensive policy that drives down our dependence on oil, that requires reductions in pollution every year, we will make the transition. And Laverne said something else that's very important. We will create many more jobs in the process. Each dollar we spend on energy efficiency and clean energy produces 3 times as many jobs as a dollar we spend on oil and traditional
forms. But Bob Bryce says that's way out there. You can't stop drilling now. And now is when the oil is choking up into the Gulf.
Well, what we can do is stop expanding drilling into new areas, and we can start now insulating homes, expanding our use of high-efficiency vehicles, building better transportation infrastructure, building better alternatives. So we need to start now with the alternatives, and it won't happen overnight. We're not calling for shutting down all the existing pumps. That would be disruptive. But if we don't get on the path to end our dependence on oil, we'll be having the same conversation in 20 or 30 years, and that's what I want to avoid.
Let's go to Victoria in Hudson, Massachusetts. Victoria, you're on the air.
I'd like to know why the federal government is not making more effort in cleaning up this horrible, horrible mess. It seems to me that it just proves the government is in the oil drillers' pockets.
Well, now, why is that, Victoria? If they, I mean, they've got an interest in cleaning it up if they could.
What's happening? And yet we're standing by. Why didn't we get the videos as soon as they were available? Why don't we have flotillas of barges sucking up this clogging, killing, floating death that's going around the Gulf and up the coast of Florida?
It may, Victoria. I think a lot of people are asking just that. We'll pick it up. Here's the president on Friday talking about this cozy relationship he's saying has to be ended. Maybe that's part of the reason. Here he is.
For too long, for a decade or more, there's been a cozy relationship between the oil companies and the federal agency that permits them to drill. Seems as if permits were too often issued based on little more than assurances of safety from the oil companies. That cannot and will not happen anymore.
Okay, now we say, but the oil is already flowing. Robert Bryce, how do you look at that? There's been all this reporting on, you know,
sure,
permits that weren't there and research that wasn't done and corners that appear to have been cut. I mean, can we really regulate this more effectively? BP made, what, $6 billion in profit in the first quarter with that kind of money. Will this ever really be fail-safe regulated?
What BP is doing, what Transocean is doing, what Petrobras, mm-hmm, the Brazilian National Oil Company, is doing in ultra-deep water is the terrestrial equivalent of the space program. They're operating this entire blowout. It's a story of extremes. They're operating in extreme water depths, extreme temperatures, extreme expense, extreme depth of the well once underneath the ocean floor. This is like the Challenger disaster. There's no, you know, could it have been prevented? Yeah, probably. Looking back at what all the things that happened, that BP is saying that, you know, the corners that might appear to have been cut. Interestingly enough, I just got a press release from Petrobras, the mm-hmm, Brazilian national oil company.
Yep.
Last month, they had record production from the offshore, and they're in doing the same kind of drilling that that BP was doing in the Gulf of Mexico. So, yes, there's going to be a political reaction to this, and there's going to be more regulation, and obviously some of that is needed, and that's fine. But it is, again, I mean, I'm sorry to sound like a broken record, it is not going to change the global oil demand picture. There are about 1 billion motor vehicles on the roads globally now, and they don't run on electricity. They don't run on unobtainium or electrogravitics or whatever, you know, these other things. They run on oil.
Dan Lashoff, you hear our caller's suspicion about the federal role here. I mean, and we look at these profits. They're very big. Money talks. I mean, could it be regulated to safety? Even if it could, will it be, when apparently it looks like BP was kind of nickel and diming here to make a little more money off this thing, possibly even when their profits were so high?
Well, the oil industry assured us that this kind of accident couldn't happen. We had better technology. We weren't going to see the same kinds of oil spills we've seen in the past. And this shows clearly that they were just flat out wrong. So we certainly need tighter regulation of the drilling operations. We need to break the cozy dependence between the oil industry and the Minerals Management Service. But Mr. Bryce is right. That won't change the demand for oil. We have to do that, too, and that's why we need a comprehensive approach that attacks the demand for oil at the same time we're tightening up on the regulation of the production.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today in the shadow of the Gulf oil spill disaster about whether The U.S. could live without offshore drilling or without more new offshore drilling. Daniel Lashoff is with us from the Natural Resources Defense Council. Robert Bryce is here from Austin, Texas. He's author of the new book, Power Hungry, The Myths of Green Energy and the Real Fuels of the Future. Here's Chuck Schumer again on Sunday, Meet the Press, a Democrat senator of New York, talking about the environmental and political impact of the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico.
Obviously, something failed dramatically here. There ought to be a fail-safe mechanism, and then there ought to be a backup fail-safe mechanism, because if you don't have it, look at the damage, and it can last for years and years and years, and it also changes all the politics. You look at a climate change bill, it's going to be harder to get one done, given the oil spill, given that drilling off the coast was part of the compromise.
Drilling is part of the compromise baked into the new climate change bill. We'll look at that. Billy in Louisville, Kentucky. Billy, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. How y'all doing?
Pretty well. What do you see, Billy?
Well, if we have to have more oil, then I would just assume it'd be regulated in the U.S. But my question to you and your guest was about what he called green myths. I know that hydrogen is not a myth. We learned about it in a freshman chemistry class.
Mm-hmm.
And even though I'm not a top-rate scientist by no means, we were able to, a friend of mine, to run a lawnmower, which is a basic same combustion engine in your car, just smaller version,
yeah,
off of hydrogen that we pulled out of water with a DC converter in our garage and ran it for quite some time. And if that technology exists, is it the big money from oil companies going to Congress that are scared of losing profits, or even the electric companies scared of losing profits? Or is it the fact that the government couldn't tax it, the hydrogen, if we can just pull it out of water, is what's keeping hydrogen out of this topic? Because I never hear anybody talk about hydrogen. They want electric cars, and it still needs oil or coal to make the electric cars charged up.
Billy, I like the image of you out in your garage making it happen right there with the lawnmower. I appreciate your call. Robert Bryce, how about it? Are we, keeping hydrogen hidden out of sight?
Well, I was in California a few weeks ago and drove Toyota's new prototype hydrogen fuel cell vehicle, and it's a sweet ride. It's an amazing car that they want to bring to market. The problem is that hydrogen is an energy carrier. It's not an energy source. It has to be manufactured, and that means you have to split it or produce it from water or from natural gas. Toyota's view is that they can see potentially a market for fuel cell vehicles, but how do they fuel them? Their view is that they would have to produce hydrogen at a local service station with a steam methane reformer and then produce hydrogen on the spot. So their view on producing hydrogen would be to produce it from natural gas. And I'm very bullish on natural gas. It's one of the fuels of the future, along with nuclear.
But you don't see hydrogen as a net gain in terms of getting away from fossil fuels, because it takes fossil fuels to create it?
Well, exactly. I mean, if you're going to produce large quantities of hydrogen, you're going to have to produce it from natural gas in the near term, because it takes a lot of energy. You have to put a lot of energy into producing the hydrogen itself, because it is not, I mean, you can't just mine hydrogen. You have to split it off from something else, whether it's water or natural gas or coal or, you know, something else.
Can I just ask, I know we've got to let you go in a moment,
sure.
And you say we've got myths around green energy. That is interesting. We're paying attention, but you know, how big a natural disaster would it take for us to say we can't do this anymore? I mean, let's say a big part of the Gulf of Mexico is, I don't know, killed off here for a long time. That's pretty big.
I take your point, Tom, and I'm not going to argue with it. The key thing is that we have to remember that energy transitions are very slow. And why is that? Because we have such a huge installed base. We have 1 billion motor vehicles. We have tens of thousands of commercial airliners. All of them, we have our entire electric grid. The 50% of our electricity comes from coal. Any transition away from the sources that we're using now, and Mr. Lashoff, I'm not opposed to, you know, his ideas about saying we need to start, but we have to be realistic about our ability to just pivot. And we can't just pivot and say, okay, well, we quit and we're going to just drive hydrogen-fueled cars or something else. The infrastructure and the cost to change change what we're doing is a trillion, multi-trillions of dollars process that will take decades.
Robert Bryce, author of Power Hungry, thank you very much for being with us from Austin.
Thanks a million.
Let's get Mark in Acton, Massachusetts, on the air. Mark, you're on.
Hi. You know, they say patriotism is the last refuge of a scoundrel, and I'm beginning to hear a lot of this being injected into the discussion about whether we need to expand oil drilling. The idea being that it's patriotic because this is American oil, and it's going to reduce our dependence on foreign oil. And what I'd like your guest to comment on is the fact that It's just not true. I don't get a break at the pump because there's oil being produced in Alaska. This country exports 1.8 million barrels of oil a day. If we really wanted to end our dependence on foreign oil, we'd stop exporting it. The reason we don't is because it's a global commodity and it gets sold to the best
bidder, and there's a handsome price for it. Mark, let us pick that up. Let me do that with Mark Kotchin. He joins us from Baltimore. He's an associate professor in environmental economics and policy at the School of Forestry and Environmental Studies at Yale University. Matthew Kotchin, thanks very much for being with us.
Sure, pleasure to be here.
You hear our caller saying it's a myth that we gain energy independence by this. This oil goes in a global market, and you know, we're selling tons of it away.
Well, very much related to that question, I've been listening to the interesting discussion that's been going on of whether or not we can live without it. I think that the caller raises a good point, which has really been missing from the discussion, mm-hmm. and that's that oil is actually part of a world market, and the decision about whether or not we should be drilling offshore in the U.S. depends on how it fits into that world market. So I have just a couple numbers mm-hmm, here that mm-hmm. are important to think about. Where is the oil in the world? Well, it turns out that only 2% of the proven reserves is actually within the U.S., and given our own consumption, only 12% of it actually comes from offshore sources right now. So the answer of whether or not we can do without it, I think, is definitely a yes, because there's plenty of other sources around the world where we could, in fact, get our oil from. Many of the arguments for why we should be drilling offshore often put forth are that it will decrease the price of oil or it will reduce our reliance on foreign imports. Mm-hmm. But given the small share of oil that we produce ourselves, I think neither of those effects are actually really important. The real issue here is that the oil is actually worth a lot of money. And so the question is not whether or not we can do without it, it's should we do without it or do we want to do without it because of the large sums of money that we're talking about in terms of that oil. And I think that that's where there's a real potential opportunity to build this bridge that's been discussed in terms of transitioning to alternative sources of energy by using that as a useful source of revenue.
Well, you're the environmental economist, so help us with that question. How do you weigh, it's very valuable stuff, BP's making huge $6 billion in the first quarter profits globally on oil. How do you weigh the value of that oil, then, against the cost of environmental damage like we're seeing right now in the Gulf of Mexico? Can you draw a line and say, you know, and tote it up and say, this is worth it or this just isn't?
Well, it's not surprising that BP has such large profits. I mean, it is one of the largest companies in the world. And so if we compare it to other large companies in the world that aren't just oil, it's not surprising that they are making a lot of money. And in fact, they probably should. People are actually benefiting from this oil. But one of the things from a public policy perspective that we need to think about is weighing the costs and benefits of the oil in terms of the benefits go both to the oil companies themselves, but also we get a substantial amount of tax revenue from that oil in addition to those profits. But then there's also the potential environmental damage that's out there and the challenge in structuring policies and determining how much care should be put into constructing those oil rigs and preventing things like this blowout is that a lot of the environmental damages are what we refer to as non-market damages, things that are difficult to quantify, and we don't actually know what the full economic impacts are. For example, you could imagine a couple years from now when people are actually starting to really get a grasp on what the damages from this spill are in quantifying the cost to commercial fisheries and recreational mm-hmm. activities. But what about the impacts on ecosystems or the long-term viability of those marshlands, which provide important values for storm surges, particularly in the Gulf region? How do we actually put a number on that? How do we quantify it? And building that into the calculation is a challenge.
If you were king of the world or in charge of U.S. energy policy, would you stop drilling for oil? Could we stop at least drilling for new oil? Or is that not practical, reasonable, or possible?
Well, I think also one of your callers actually provided an interesting perspective where it is true in the short term, despite the fact that we want to build a bridge to different sources of energy in order to deal with our long-term both energy problem, which is also very closely related to the climate change issue, it is true that we are going to be consuming a lot of oil in the short run. And if we decide to turn off all the spigots on domestic supplies, what is definitely the case is we're just going to be getting that oil from foreign supplies. So the question is, what are the regulations in those areas? because if we actually impose if we turn off all the U.S. Rigs in the Gulf of Mexico, does all of a sudden that mean there's going to be a lot more that are under the management of Mexico itself? And so we need to think about those consequences. But the other thing is thinking about, given that we're going to be consuming that oil, and if we're going to be supplying some of that from domestic supplies, is thinking about, again, this massive amount of revenue from either existing tax policies, either the leasing rights and also the royalties, or thinking about another form of revenue-raising potential in the form of a carbon tax, where we could actually use that to invest in research and development in order to promote some of these other alternative technologies and sources of energy, such as wind and solar, and improving our power grids in ways that can actually try to solve the long-term problem of transitioning from a fossil fuel-based economy into alternative sources of energy.
Daniel Lashoff, we've just got a half a minute here, alas, but maybe an irony that the Kerry-Lieberman climate bill that just got put forward last week has offshore drilling right in it. Do you see that going forward with offshore drilling full steam ahead right in the middle of it? Are we going to see any real change in the pace of offshore drilling in this country?
Well, I think we need to strip out the offshore drilling provisions of that bill, but we absolutely should take this opportunity to move legislation forward that limits our emissions of carbon pollution and makes those limits tighter every year, which is what the Kerry-Lieberman bill proposes to do. So Senator Schumer says it complicates it. It does in one sense, but on the other hand, this bill clearly puts a spotlight on our need to fundamentally change how we produce and use energy. So I believe that will actually propel us forward and cause us to enact comprehensive legislation this year.
I want to thank you both for being with us this hour. Daniel Lashoff, Director of the Climate Center at the Natural Resources Defense Council, joining us from Washington. Thank you very much for being here, Daniel.
Thanks, Tom.
And Matthew Kupchan at the School of Forestry and Environmental Studies at Yale University, joining us from Baltimore. Matthew Kupchan, thanks so much for your time.
Pleasure to be here.
In a moment, Graduation Day Speaker Al Gore on the Gulf of Mexico oil spill, flooding in Nashville, and climate change. This is On Point. This graduation season, we're broadcasting excerpts from notable commencement addresses around the country. On Friday, former Vice President and Nobel Peace Prize winner Al Gore addressed the 1,030 graduates of the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville. In this excerpt, Vice President Gore speaks of the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico and recent flooding in Nashville in the context, he told graduates, of the climate crisis. Here is former Vice President Gore speaking last Friday in Knoxville.
To put it in perspective, this morning we heard the news that this oil spill down in the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico, 50 miles off Louisiana, a mile underwater, is gushing oil at a much higher rate than they had originally said, maybe 10 times as much. And according to the estimates this morning, it's spilling out the equivalent of one Exxon Valdez oil spill every 4 days. Now, they told us it was safe to do that, and without going into the particulars of why they were wrong about that, I want to note the fact that all this oil spilling out into the Gulf of Mexico is causing a lot of damage, but it is far from the only uncontrolled gusher of pollution into the environment. Matter of fact, just 40 miles west of here, I passed by there on the way up here yesterday from Middle Tennessee. You remember that coal ash spill? What it has in common with the spill in the Gulf of Mexico is it's connected to our dependence on carbon-based fuels. About as far to the northeast as that is to the west, you see evidence of this mountaintop mining practice, which spills all the debris down into the valleys and poisons the creeks and drinking water for many communities. But the biggest uncontrolled gusher of pollution by far is the global warming pollution that we're putting up there all the time at the rate of 90 million tons per day. And they're telling us that's all right, too. Each of the average coal-fired generating plants in the United States every day puts three times as much global warming pollution into the atmosphere as that oil spill is putting into the Gulf of Mexico. and there are 1,400 of them in the United States alone. Worldwide, every 3 or 4 seconds, we're putting as much global warming pollution into the atmosphere as that oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico is putting into the ocean every single day. And it causes consequences. It's not controversial that CO2 traps heat. And since we have expanded at the rate of 90 million tons per day, it's trapping a lot more heat. The North Polar Ice Cap is disappearing. Virtually all of the mountain glaciers in the entire world are in the process of melting, disrupting the hydrological cycle. Average humidity has increased 4% already, so we get bigger downpours. And the scientists always say that it's a mistake to say a particular large weather event like the flooding of Nashville 2 weeks ago is caused by global warming, because there's natural variability in normal weather. But we're loading the dice, as the scientists say. We're dramatically increasing the odds of large downpours coming all in a short period of time. Thousands of my neighbors in Nashville lost their homes and did not have flood insurance. Why didn't they have flood insurance? Because they were assured when they bought their homes that they lived way outside the historic floodplain. So when the Army Corps of Engineers said this was a once-in-a-thousand-year rain, they might have felt justified in saying, well, if it only comes once every 1,000 years, maybe we don't have to worry about it. But all over the world, once-in-500-year events, once-in-1,000-year events are occurring more frequently.
Former Vice President Al Gore speaking to graduates of the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, last Friday. To see video of Gore's address, go to our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.